Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the state Supreme Court this morning will hear arguments in a case challenging a voter-approved ballot measure.
And a tiny desert concert from a band that decided to downsize. But first.
As you've been hearing all over the news, Turning Point USA co-founder Charlie Kirk was shot and killed yesterday. There's a lot to say about who he was and what his legacy will be, and those are all conversations that will happen over the coming weeks. So today, I wanted to offer this snapshot of my brief experience with Kirk, a charismatic Arizonan who I covered at what would turn out to be the apex of his influence. Here at The Show, we've been following Kirk and Turning Point USA for a while. Turning Point is one of the most influential organizations in American politics and one of the most conservative. They're also based here in Phoenix. So last fall, before and after the election, we talked about Turning Point's ability to merge evangelical religious fervor with right-wing cultural issues.
Charlie preached. He said things like, the word of God says, and then he would quote scripture. And then he would tether that scripture directly to certain aspects of, you know, his vision of American history.
We looked at the ways Turning Point more or less took over President Trump's voter turnout operation.
Turning Point is also very conscious of wanting to do this, not just for Trump, but to do it for years to come and for elections to come. And they sort of want to build themselves into the hard drive of how we do elections in this country.
And when J.D. Vance came to Glendale last summer to headline his first Arizona rally as Donald Trump's running mate, producer Nick Sanchez and I were there. We watched as Charlie Kirk warmed up the crowd for Vance, and we couldn't help noticing that, to our ears at least, Kirk got as much applause, if not more, than Vance.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage founder of Turning Point USA, Charlie Kirk.
Around that time, we started reaching out to Turning Point in hopes of getting an interview with Charlie Kirk. We never heard back. But in December, we were able to get a couple press passes for an event called America Fest. America Fest is this massive gathering of activists, influencers, entrepreneurs, students, and hardcore MAGA Republicans of all ages. It was held at Phoenix Convention Center just a few short weeks after President Trump's victory. And on the first night, thousands packed the main hall for the kickoff event, a speech from Charlie Kirk. Standing about 10 rows back from the stage in a crowd of people waving flags and literally jumping up and down, I watched as the lights in the hall dimmed. A video began to play on floor-to-ceiling screens behind the stage.
Let's rewind the clock to January 7, 2021. We never wavered in our support of Donald J. Trump.
I know that he fulfilled his promises, and I know he would do it again.
I want to thank our good friend Charlie Kirk for everything that he's done to build Turning Point.
The screens began showing a montage of pundits praising Kirk's work on the 2024 election.
The single most effective organizer of conservatives in the United States.
One of the most formidable voices in politics for decades to come.
You have been on the ground, and your team has been...
The video ended and the lights went out. For a moment, a hush fell over the room. Kirk appeared in silhouette behind a baffold and then walked out on stage, his arms stretched wide.
Welcome to America Fest, everybody.
Kirk attempted to speak, but the crowd wouldn't stop chanting, "Thank you, Charlie." When they finally settled down, Kirk launched into a freewheeling, conversational speech. He spoke without notes or a teleprompter, leaning in hard on issues like immigration, guns, and gender, frequently interrupted by cheers so loud, my recorder nearly spiked. Charlie Kirk had them eating out of his hand. And towards the end, when the room got quiet, he switched gears. He warned the crowd not to get too comfortable.
We are in the driver's seat, and that comes with a lot of obligation. We are the cultural force. We are ascendant. The bad guys are scattered, confused, and afraid, and they will be back. And the posture should not be one that, oh, we won, and that we're the greatest, and that we're indestructible. No, it's the opposite. It should be one of humility, that we are actually in charge. And we didn't earn it, but we have an obligation to deliver.
Kirk explained what he meant by not earning it. Turning Point's power, he said, came from God. And God, he claimed, was on their side.
This is the greatest country ever to exist in the history of the world. And I can say, wow, there was a debate. Is God done with this country? Now I can say confidently, no. God is not done with America, and our best days are ahead. God bless you guys. Thank you so much.
Strobe lights flickered, the music swelled, and Charlie Kirk strolled off stage, seeming genuinely convinced that America's best days were ahead. Charlie Kirk was 31 years old. He is survived by his wife Erica and two children. As of this recording, no one was being held in connection with the shooting.
Arizona Supreme Court will hear arguments later this morning in a challenge to Proposition 211, known as the Voters' Right to Know Act. The measure generally requires groups that spend a certain amount of money to try to influence elections to disclose where that money comes from. The initiative won the approval of 72% of voters in 2022, but it's been the subject of litigation on both the state and federal level since. With me to talk about how we got here and what the justices are likely to hear today is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. And Howie, what are the arguments that challengers are making here?
What this really comes down to is an argument between the right to privacy and the First Amendment right to know. This is crucial because the challengers are saying, look, Arizona has a very specific right of privacy in its constitution. It's even broader than in the federal constitution. And they're arguing that forcing people who contribute to an organization to have their names made public interferes with their rights to privacy. The problem with that is that when voters approved Prop 211, they said, but we have a right to know, in fact, who's trying to contribute to campaigns. I mean, look, we've had a situation in Arizona prior to Prop 211 where you'd have, if you give to directly to a candidate, your name is disclosed. That's clear. You know, it shows up on campaign finance reports. If you give to a group that's called Arizonans for Arizona, and they in turn spend money on independent expenditures for a candidate, the only thing that shows up is that Arizonans for Arizona spent a lot of money. It doesn't say maybe that $1 million of that came from a special interest group. And the argument is, voters need to know because it may affect their decision. Now, we actually had a very good example of that many years ago. Back in 2014, a number of groups put more than $10 million into successful efforts to elect Republicans to the Corporation Commission. Mm-hmm. A couple of years later, the commission approved a 4.5% rate hike for Arizona Public Service. But we didn't know until 5 years later that it was Pinnacle West Capital Corporation, which is the APS parent, that they'd been the one to give money to the Free Enterprise Club and another organization called Save Our Future Now. And that money was, for lack of a better word, that organization, for lack of a better word, was laundering the money and giving it to help elect the Republicans and help defeat the Democratic candidates. Now, would people want to know that? That's the argument by the state, by people like Terry Goddard, who pushed for Prop 211, that people deserve to know that information. The argument by the challengers here in terms of, from the Goldwater Institute is that's nobody's business.
Howie, does the fact that this initiative was so overwhelmingly supported by voters when it was on the ballot, does that have any play here? Does that matter at all?
Well, strictly speaking, it doesn't matter to the court. The court doesn't care if it won by 50.1% or if 99% of voters supported it. It still comes down to what does the Constitution allow? And you've got the whole issue of where is the right? Again, particularly we come back to the Privacy Act. The Privacy Act in the Arizona Constitution spells out that, quote, every person may freely speak, write, and publish on all subjects, being responsible for the abuse of that right. The last provision is you say something that's a lie, you get sued for libel. And the argument is that by Andrew Gould, who's one of the lawyers for Goldwater, is that the government can't force somebody's private decisions on who to fund, particularly through another group, to be made public. And the problem with that is that it is true the Constitution is broader, but the lower court judges looked at that, also pointed out that the Arizona Constitution has a specific provision requiring the legislature to provide for campaign finance disclosure laws. So you really have two conflicting provisions here. Well, now, it's important to note that this is not just the Arizona courts that have ruled that way. Because remember, the Goldwater Institute lost at the trial court level. They lost at the appellate court level, and now they're going to Supreme Court. There was also a separate case filed by something called For Americans for Prosperity. This is an organization that was founded years ago by the Koch brothers, very conservative. Mm-hmm. And they tried to present the same constitutional arguments. And Judge Rosalind Silver in federal court said that their arguments were a, quote, strained reading of the law, calling their arguments hard to follow, and even calling their reading of the statute implausible and divorced from context. And so she said, disclosure regimes aimed at identifying who is speaking are only effective if the disclosures identify the speaker. So she said, it's perfectly constitutional under the federal constitution. And as the lower courts here have said, it's perfectly constitutional under the Arizona Constitution. Now, what will the Arizona Supreme Court do? You know, we have a 7-member court. The court agreed to take it up because it only takes 3 of the 7 justices to put a case on the calendar. But the Goldwater Institute and the challengers need 4 of those justices to go along with their arguments. Where they'll get that, we'll find out probably in a couple of months.
Well, I was going to ask, Howie, if there's any reason to think that the Goldwater Institute, the challengers, will try different arguments than the ones that, as you point out, have not been that successful in the court so far, or if they're maybe just counting on a different group of judges hearing the same arguments and feeling differently about them.
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, some of it gets really deeply in the weeds in terms of whether the right to privacy is subject to strict scrutiny or relaxed scrutiny under the Constitution. And that's an argument that only a lawyer could love. But essentially, they're presenting the same arguments, right to privacy and the right to be left alone under the Arizona Constitution. And that becomes a strong argument. Oh, look, we've got a lot of folks who are interfering with everyone's right to privacy, the whole argument with doxing. And that's been, in fact, been one of the arguments of people, like the Center for Arizona Policy, which is one of the plaintiffs. They say people who give to us and then we give to other groups are going to have their names disclosed and they're going to be harassed because of the fact that they support us. But when you're trying to influence politics, when you're trying to elect someone governor, when you're trying to defeat a ballot measure, so far the courts have said it's really a simple question. You have voluntarily put yourself into this position. If you don't want to be doxxed, if you don't want to have your name disclosed, don't say anything. Don't participate. Is that unfair? Is that silencing people who don't want to be silenced? Well, the courts have ruled all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court that money is speech. I mean, that goes back to the whole United case and the idea that that you cannot, you know, limit the amount of money that people spend on these independent expenditures. Well, if money is speech, then the question becomes, are you interfering with individual speech? And I think that's going to be what the court is going to have to face, and whether 4 of the 7 justices are going to have to decide one way or the other which side they fall on.
Yeah, and they'll be hearing those arguments just a little bit later on this morning. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, as always, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Good to talk to you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a local singer comforted by the fact that no matter what happens in love, at least she can create a song out of it.
But first, researchers continue to analyze the sample brought back to Earth from the asteroid Bennu. And among the things they found is that Bennu's parent asteroid was made up of materials from all over the solar system. Those findings are among those published in a trio of new papers based on the results of 2023's OSIRIS-REx mission. Tom Zega is a professor of planetary sciences at the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory at the University of Arizona. He's been among the scientists studying the return sample. He joins me to talk about some of what he and his colleagues have found. And Tom, what stands out to you about what the team has found out so far about the composition of Bennu?
Yeah, so the kind of work that we do in studying meteorites and samples returned from asteroids and people at other institutions that do this, we sort of been at the mercy of what falls from the sky, right? So we can't get into our Battlestar Galactica or our Starship Enterprise and fly out somewhere in the solar system and easily collect stuff. Not until we had sample return missions like this one, like OSIRIS-REx. And one of the unique things about having a sample return mission like this is that it brings back samples from the surface of an asteroid that are not weathered or altered in any way by Earth's atmosphere. And among the major findings from our study is that the sample is composed of 80% or more of water-bearing clay material.
What is the significance of that?
Well, we know, of course, that life, at least life on Earth, requires water. And we know that two-thirds of Earth's surface is composed of water. So one big question is, where did all this water come from? How did the early Earth get its water? And there are different hypotheses in the scientific literature about how Earth got its water. Among them is things like comets could have delivered water to the early Earth, because we think comets have lots of water locked up inside them in the form of ice or in other water-bearing minerals like clay minerals. It turns out, looking at a carbonaceous asteroid like Bennu, a lot of it, most of it, is composed of this water-bearing material and organic compounds. And so it's very possible that material like what we're finding in asteroid Bennu could have very, very likely seeded the early Earth with organic compounds and possibly even water.
And that would, I would imagine, indicate that there is, if not currently, then at one point, the possibility of water elsewhere, somewhere in the solar system, right?
Absolutely. So when we look at the minerals that are comprising the asteroid samples, not just Bennu, but also Ryugu, which was material returned by the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency, or JAXA, those two contain lots of water-bearing clay material. And we think that what was happening some 4.5 billion years ago is that these asteroids accreted a combination of silicate dust, some metal, with some carbon, organic material, and icy material from the outer solar system that could have been water ice, it could have been CO2 ice, it could have been ammonia-bearing ice, it could have been a combination of those things. So once that ice accreted together with all this dusty material from the early solar system, all we needed, or all it needed, was a little bit of heat to melt that ice, make a liquid. That liquid now is in contact with solids, and now you have everything you need to start doing all kinds of chemistry.
So what questions then does that raise for you? Like, what do you want to find out next based on that particular finding from Bennu?
Well, among the next phases of the mission would be, we know what it's mostly composed of. We generally know the kinds of chemical reactions that led to the products that we see today. One of the outstanding questions is, when exactly did that happen? Can we actually put a timestamp on it? And so there's a way to measure the timing or dating of that, and that's by looking at radioactive isotopes that may have been part of the sample. for early in solar system history. And so by measuring some of the radiogenic isotopes with sophisticated instruments and mass spectrometers, we can get a sense of when all this chemistry happened and actually put a very precise age date on some of this chemistry. Another one of the key questions, of course, is when we look at the organic compounds in the sample, and there are quite a few organic compounds. We've identified 15 of the 20 amino acids that life uses to build proteins, and we've identified all five nucleobases that are the genetic components of DNA in the return sample. So we'd like to know, is that the complete diversity of those organic compounds, or do we see more organic compounds in the sample? And so the next phases of sample analysis will almost certainly involve continued measurements of the organic component.
So I know that one of the other things that you guys found with this sample is that the parent comet where Bennu, the assumption is, broke off from, had material from sort of all over the place. And I'm wondering how typical or atypical is something like that?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So again, those of us that have been studying meteorites for many decades, there's always been this general idea or hypothesis about how meteorites form and where they come from. So to give you a feel for it, meteorites come from parent asteroids. And asteroids largely reside in a belt between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, okay? And so we tend to think of this belt as being static. It's there, not much is really going on. But in the early solar system, we don't think it was so static. Things were moving around. There were lots of impacts. Things were dynamic, right? And as it turns out, when we look at the return sample, we don't find some features in it that we would have expected based on what we had seen from meteorites or what we've looked at in meteorites for many decades now. And so it's sort of upending our idea of how the solar system maybe was put together. And so samples from asteroids like Bennu and Ryugu look very similar to another group of meteorites that we have in our terrestrial collections called CI chondrites. And they seem to suggest that much of the material that comprised these asteroids came from the outer solar system rather than the inner solar system. And there may be a lot more of them in the asteroid belt than we previously thought based on what we have in our terrestrial collections.
Tom Zega is a professor of planetary sciences at the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory at the University of Arizona. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Tucson artist Amber Doe works in a lot of mediums: sculpture, textiles, dyes, performance, and more. Her latest work will incorporate dance and movement, too, telling a story of migration and how African and Mexican cultures have mixed.
It's called Ancestral Grammar, and it began for her last year when she went to Oaxaca, Mexico, to research the indigo plant. Our co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about it.
My initial interest in indigo as a plant came through my maternal uncle doing our family history a really long time ago, pre-Google, pre-internet, almost just kind of archival work. And he found out that part of our family originated from a plantation that had indigo and rice and cotton as its main commodity. So I kind of became curious about this plant and the fact that it has a relationship across the planet.
Okay, so let's back up then and talk about your work in general. You are an interdisciplinary artist. You work in many different mediums, but you often work with textiles and in sculpture, and you use things that are really interesting, like palm fronds. There are ropes here, like cotton ropes, flowers. Sometimes you use hair extensions, right? Tell us about the things that you use and why.
I think that if I wasn't an artist, I would be a historian. I think above all, I'm a bit of a history nerd, and I like to use materials as a metaphor. So if I'm in the work, I'm trying to tell a story about a person or a narrative or a way that something came to be, I find that it's really important to use the natural environment to tell part of the story and then to tell kind of the human connection to that story. I love textile as a medium just because it was traditionally seen as women's work, and we have such a long history of textile production within the United States that it's a way for me to place myself in a historical context, always telling some sort of hidden story, and textile is my way in traditionally.
So this piece, this most recent piece you're working on called Ancestral Grammar, you said is a continuation of an earlier project that is really pretty extensive called Tactile Cosmology. And I'm looking at the images of this, and I would love for you to describe it for the audience because this is radio, but it involves photographs and kind of where they're placed, right?
Yes. Tactile Cosmology came about in a way because I was also kind of studying our relationship to the natural world through the formal sciences of geology, zoology, paleontology, and how all of those sciences are essentially an offset of sort of mining, extraction, all of these sort of things that take place and what they produce. And so even studying the people that worked in there with tactile cosmology, I was interested in something called Lowell cloth. And it was also called slave cloth at one point, just recognizing that at every facet of life, this thing that is the first thing that touches our body when we come out of our, you know, birth canal essentially is something that has a history, has a story, and it tells us a lot about where we've been and where we're going.
So how does this relate to your own story?
I think that it relates to my own story because in alignment with my uncle's research when I was younger and peering about rice, indigo, and cotton, I did an earlier piece called Self-Portrait that is essentially composed of cotton rope that I've unraveled. I made the tubing that gives it the shape of kind of like a hoop skirt of that era in time, kind of antebellum South looking. And I did it in the material that it's in to be a reflection of my descendants. Like if I was considered descended from a cash crop as a person at the same time as materials like tobacco and cotton were, I wanted to see what that would look like in a different material and how that could shape how we feel about ourselves in relationship to the concept of, you know, material in general.
Hmm. This is it's a beautiful piece, and it's interesting that it's called Self-Portrait because of course it doesn't look like you.
Yeah.
but it does evoke that hoop skirt and has such a shape to it. So describe for us what ancestral grammar might look like going forward. This sounds like it'll involve a story map. You've got textiles involved obviously as well.
I do have textile involved, and it always kind of starts in my head from there. But there's going to be a lot more movement, I would say, with ancestral grammar. Being based in the Southwest, my daughter is enrolled in folklorico programs. Mm-hmm. And so her teacher has kind of explained to us all these different regions of Mexico that I didn't know about coming from the East Coast. And some of them have a really traditional African connection to them, because at one point there were more enslaved people in Mexico than there were even in the United States, which I didn't know about until pretty recently. And knowing that that sort of informs the costumes, informs the movements, and informs the music, some of the things that my daughter's learning made me more fascinated. So there's going to be choreographed pieces that sort of complement the textiles, which I see as a screen. I'm going to like have movement in front of them, have props in front of them, have some video in front of them at different points. So it does feel like a journey. That journey is definitely a migration. So sort of coming from the doors of no return, symbolically the coasts off of West Africa, leading us to new coasts, and then finally leading us to desert landscapes.
So yes, the migration there. I love that idea of combining something like folklorico, right? Like this traditional Mexican dance that you said your daughter is taking with these kinds of textile sculptural elements that you do. This is what you mean when you say you're an interdisciplinary artist.
Absolutely. Yes, I will use almost whatever medium I can get my hand on to tell a fuller story.
So let me ask you lastly, then, how this fits into the picture of your broader work in general. I'm reading here that your work is something called trans species ancestor worship. Describe that for us.
That is because in all of my work, and specifically with something like ancestral grammar or tactile cosmology, since I'm talking about migration, there's always a migration that takes place, not just in a human form or the human realm, but also animals. And I think a lot about sea mammals, for example, and how they sort of mimic our placement, like their pathways across the Atlantic, and how there's a belief that the gray whale, for some reason, disappeared for a while, post the transatlantic slave trade. So what happened to this disappearing species that kind of fell along with us on this pathway? So there's some kind of a sea element to take us from our beginning point at the doors of no return and take us to this desert scape where you have, I'm using feathers from birds that are native to these parts of the country to sort of show this migration we kind of all make. And it's super natural, and it's something that is standard in terms of human and world history. We all migrate.
We all migrate. All right. We will end on that note. That is Amber Doe, an interdisciplinary artist, joining us. She is one of the 9 recipients of MoCA Tucson's Grants for Artists program. We've been talking about her upcoming project for that called Ancestral Grammar. Amber, thank you. Thank you for telling us about this.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Time now for the next installment in our Tiny Desert Concert Series. Today we're featuring a band called New Misphoria. New Misphoria is a 2-piece ensemble featuring guitarist and lead singer Lee Parada and drummer Bella Crump. They joined us for an interview and performance at Stinkweed's record store. I began our conversation by asking Lee where she gets her ideas.
I don't really sit down to write. It's more of like a reaction to something happening in my life that feels like it needs the space to be processed.
Was music always the way that felt best to you to do that?
Yeah, I think so. I wrote one of my first songs when I was in fifth grade, and it was called Broken Hearted.
In fifth grade?
Yeah. Music has always been the way that I move through those feelings.
Tell me more about what you mean by that.
I get, like, I don't know, like, love feels like a song to me in and of itself. And I think when I experience, like, romance, good or bad, or everything in between, I can, like, hear the music I associate with those feelings, like, while it's happening. And so if it comes to an end, I, like, finally get to take all of what I heard in my head the whole time and, like, put it into words.
Oh my gosh. So it's is that a sense of comfort for you? Like the idea that no matter what happens, you know there's like a song that might come out of it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think it's okay if it doesn't go as I wanted it to, because it's an opportunity for me to grow into myself through my own art.
Wow. Can I ask you, if I may, at least in the songs that I have heard of yours so far, mm-hmm. in Acronym, you sing like very directly, I'm trying.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like trying and the sense of effort that love takes, that romance takes, the uncertainty about whether to really like let yourself go with it or hold yourself back from it,
mm-hmm.
seems consistent in your lyrics. Is that something you're thinking about consciously?
No, it's so conscious, and it's cool that you noticed that, because I think I have a habit of not always being able to go with the flow if it's like my heart on the line. And so when I talk about in that song specifically, like I'm trying, I think when I wrote that song, I was 19 and I'm 25 now. So it's been around for a long time. That was at a time that I really was trying to prove myself. And if you listen to kind of like the evolution of some of my lyrics, it changes and it becomes less of I'm trying to like, I tried, or like I gave it what I could, and I'm okay that like it didn't pan out.
Yeah. Bella, let me ask you, when you're gonna put drums to a song that Lee has written, well, actually, let me back up. Is that how it works?
Lee definitely comes to me with songs that she's written, and it is kind of a funny joke within our friend group that something happens in Lee's life and oh, there's gonna be a song about this. When Lee brings me a song, it's usually mostly finished, but we'll sort of work on little dynamics and intricacies of the instrumentals together.
Okay. Well, so that makes me want to ask something, because something I'm always interested in when you see duos where it's just guitar and drums and vocals is that the drums are having to do this kind of interesting thing, in my opinion, and please tell me if you disagree, where you're obviously providing the rhythm, but in a way you're also kind of a harmony instrument. Does it feel that way to you as you're doing it?
It definitely does feel that way. When I'm playing the drums, it's sort of like each specific drum in a drum kit that I'm using provides a certain timbre and a certain resonance that adds to each note and each chord. It definitely feels like it all comes as one once the drums are added. Drums are sort of like a form of meditation for me. I almost get like lost in them in a way when I'm doing it.
A form of meditation. Can you say more about that?
Absolutely. Each drum having a certain vibration sort of has an effect on my brain and my body that makes it feel like I'm almost transcending and being relieved of my anxieties.
So that reminds me of what you were saying, Lee, in your songwriting about how if you're going through a difficult experience, you know that there's a song that will come out of it that will kind of help you integrate it or process it. Can I ask you, in the vein of what Bella was just saying, something again that I noticed about your guys' songs is that on the guitar, you're mostly playing rhythm lines. You're not playing like big melodic lead lines. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you guys leave a lot of space for Bella to kind of like move around the kit and create a kind of lead line, mm-hmm. sort of, in the music. Was that something that was just there from the beginning, or have you kind of found that through collaboration, and how does it interact with your lyrics?
I think I used to write in a way that wasn't really considering anything else, mm-hmm. which was great. You know, it's like it's nice to just write totally intuitively, and I still do that in my own way, but now when I write, I'm always thinking of her, because I understand that her drums will form the song into what it is. I'm a very emotional drummer, mm-hmm. I feel like, where you wouldn't think of drums as holding a lot of emotion, but I feel like Lee's music has really impacted the way I play as well.
All right, so we're going to listen to one of your songs. What are you going to play for us?
We're going to play one of our songs called Reflective Skin.
Yeah.
off my reflective skin.
As I understand it, New Miss 4A was not always just the two of you. There were mm-hmm. other members previously. Mm-hmm. I could imagine a scenario where a band that has, I don't know how many it was originally. Was it four?
Four.
It was four. Okay. I could imagine a band that has four people going down to two and then thinking like, all right, well, we got to find two more people. In your guys' case, you were like, I think we've actually found our right number.
Yeah.
What was that realization?
Not that this is like a bad thing in any way, but the previous two members were both men. And I think that so much of what I write about, especially in the vein of like romantic experiences as a woman, is so unique to my experience as a woman. And having men in the band made me feel sometimes misunderstood, and not because I was being misunderstood, but I was like, this is like this thing that you could never really relate to. And a lot of my music is about feeling mistreated by men in my life, and having just another woman on my team made me feel like, it's like, yeah, this feels right, because it's just you and I experiencing music as women.
That's a good point. I feel like once it was just the two of us, we kind of had to learn how to like fill space a little bit. We were able to kind of guide each other.
Yeah. Also having you, I don't think it's about necessarily being a duo. I think it's about being us.
This duo.
Yeah. I couldn't imagine it being something that could be like accessed just by being in a two-piece. It's that like I am encouraged to experience my life through music because of Bella. I feel things really heavily, and I know that Bella does too, and I think that as two people who like really experience the weight of the world in like a very real way, the dynamics come from the safety to experience everything through each other.
So there's a lyric, I'm trying but I had to restart. They never told me love would be so hard, something like that.
They never told me growing up would be so hard.
They never told me growing up would be so hard. I apologize.
Yeah. No, that's fine.
Based on what you said about having music as this kind of like emotional backstop or like safety net, I could imagine a scenario where a songwriter like yourself might be worried mm-hmm. about what would happen if like a relationship goes well, or like something happens in life that you don't need the music to salvage the experience, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Is that something you're concerned about? Is that something you think about?
All the time. All the time. It's so real. I write about heartbreak and like turmoil. That's my thing. And when I've been in really beautiful relationships where I didn't feel like I needed that outlet, I stopped writing music. Yeah, I think about that all the time, and it's been a very real thing of like, oh, I can't write because nothing is going wrong. Oh my God. Yeah.
Well, thank you both so much for talking to us. What are you going to take us out on?
We're going to play you out on our song called Acronym. I'm trying.
ghosting me. In this mansion of jealousy, I forgot about your voice. You're happy now, and I look like the clown. Can you see that I'm frowning now? My let go hit the bone, hit the bone.
That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.